in men were used to waste. It was usual. But this was beyond anything even they had seen. The slash and chips from the hewer's axes was knee-high. The Scugogs had enough squared timber for two rafts at the end of the winter. The bigger raft, made up of 50 cribs, belonged to old William, and the smaller raft to son Cato. The rafts traveled well enough on smooth water, but broke apart at the falls. There was nothing for it but to disassemble them and send the cribs through, one by one, then put all together again. Ginot often thought of free logs surging through the boisterous spring freshet of the Penobscot. But of course rafts did not get into killing jams. When the rafts arrived in Montreal, they could not find a place to moor. Scugog had made no arrangements for the unwieldy mass of timbers, and it seemed to the choppers and rivermen that they were paid off grudgingly, that Scugog's fingers lingered over the money. The tavern word was that he was having difficulty selling his timber. A second son, Blade Scugog, was running a shanty farther up the Gatineau. The cells shifted to this son's shanty, glad to work with round logs. It was too bad to leave Diamond Bob's grub, but the regret faded when they heard the famous cook had abandoned Scugog Pear in mid-season in favor of Montreal, where he opened an oyster house. This younger Scugog, whose deep, scratched-up voice was familiar to the river's lumbermen, despised not only the uncertain rafting enterprise, but his father's stupidity in cutting without permits and permissions. He quickly got a cutting permit for himself after declaring he intended to make lumber for domestic enterprises, not for export.
"What do you imagine you are doing?"
shouted the older man at his contrary offspring.
"After the war ends, there will be thousands of settlers coming into this country. They will need boards and shingles to build houses."
To himself he added,
"Not bloody squared warship timbers that the Crown can seize without remuneration. You, sir, are a reckless fool. There will always be wars, always a need for squared timbers. You will fail with your trust in chimerical men who will never come to settle such rude lands. Do not ask me for aid when poverty brings you down. And do you not come to me with your square timbers, hoping for an introduction to purchasers," said the son in his rough voice.
Blade Scugog's sawmill ran through the summer, but at the end of dry September it was caught in a fast-moving wildfire and burned to the ground. The ambitious son refused to see he was ruined, rushed to Quebec, and leveraged money to rebuild.
"I may not know much about square timbers," he said, "but I know how to make money."
The settlers did come, and with them came bridges, lightning-fast clearing, plans for crib-sized timber slides around the worst falls, canals to bypass rough water, large new settlements, cemeteries, flour mills, and postal service. They pushed back the wildwood. Civilization rushed into the trees. The cells moved on to other camps after Scugog's fire. Pine choppers from Maine arrived every season, now and then someone they knew. On Ginot's first day on the Fisher-Heldon Cut, walking to the marked trees behind a knot of choppers, he recognized the familiar jaunty stride of Joe Martel from Marchand's long-ago Penobscot camp at the time of Francois.
"Joe," he called. "Joe Martel! What you do here?"
Martel turned around, his black beard roughed out like a grouse's breast, a gleam of teeth, a happy exclamation.
"Ginot, Sal! Ginot! You are here?"
He waited until Ginot came up to him and they walked together.
"I seen 4, 5 Penobscots up here in the Canada trees. It's bad in Maine now, you know. The white pine give out, cutting spruce and hardwood now, but this here..."
He waved his arm at the riches of the Gatineau.
"Looks like a pretty good chance, eh?"
He said Marchand had gone broke and was swinging an axe like the rest of them somewhere on the Gatineau. Tom Keogh was dead, decapitated by a flying log. That night after supper they talked on about the old days when they were Penobscot rivermen running on bubbles, the best in the world.
"We made our mark, by gaw."
The next winter was windy and bad for accidents. One man's axe head flew off its handle, sailed 20 feet and sheared a young chopper's face away. Widowmakers caught 3, killing 2 outright and breaking the 3rd so badly he never worked again. 2 buckers cut their feet to the bone, and night after night the men talked about the need for stouter boots. Most of them still wore heavy elk-hide mid-calf moccasins. An axe cut through one as if it were a syrup-soaked pancake. The Sell brothers and Martell made the Saturday night trek to the near settlement to drink and watch the fools, as Amboise put it, to talk with the girls, as Jeannot said. He only came for drink and company, so he said. In the settlement's 2 whorehouses, the girls made much of Jeannot, and if Amboise or Josime came in alone, always asked, "Where is Jeannot?"
"What is it they see in him?" Martell said.
Jeannot was only Jeannot, a good riverman, easygoing in character, but off a log, nothing special. He couldn't sing, did not play the fiddle, wasn't much of a step dancer. It had to be his smile and chaffing banter, for Jeannot was always good-natured when others were gloomy, and he listened to the girls' complaints with real interest.
"By now he knows more about women than anybody in the world," Josime told Martell. "He been listening to them jabber long, long years now. I guess half the brats in Maine come from Jeannot."
Martell, thinking of Francois, raised his eyebrows, but said nothing. A few winters later in the Ottawa drainage, they were again squaring timbers, this time at Harold Honey's camp. The shanty was crowded with dirty, lousy men who were strong beyond modern comprehension. The interior was always drafty and smoky. At night, exhausted by the constant swing of the axe against the living tree, they thought the rough accommodations of bare ground luxurious. The days were longer, and the taste of spring was in their mouths. The drive was only a few weeks away. At the end of one day, Honey came to them in the shanty.
"Well, boys, I guess I got some bad news. The log markets fell out the bottom. Scugog's got all the Canada business. I can't sell them logs we got on the rollway. I am broke, and will have to go back to Maine and hire out again. I can't pay nobody, but you are welcome to the logs, if you can move them."
His smile was painful. There was nothing to do but pack up and head downriver with the rest of the crew. Jeannot was the only one with any money. The Sells agreed to spend it on a blowout in Montreal and then decide whether to go back to Maine or stay in the Ottawa Valley.
"They still cut trees in Maine. Water pine is gone, but there's red pine and spruce and hardwood. There's work. Plenty work on the booms. There's still some long log drives." "Let's go west," mumbled Amboise. "Not go back to the Penobscot and that... all that."
They knew what he meant. Beatrix's grave, the old house, the choppers they knew, scabby woods and stump forests, the ghosts of dead men. Martell said that if they went west, he would go with them. In Montreal, they hit the Golden Pine, the dingiest whorehouse, but good enough for woodsmen and fur traders, even Métis and savages. They agreed to meet up afterward at the Wing King Saloon, where the proprietor not only sold liquor, but rented beds for the night in the big storeroom. The focal point of the Golden Pine was an upright log carved like a membrum virile and painted golden yellow supporting the ceiling. No food was served, but a fierce kind of fermented apple cider Madame Georgine called Calvados or Napoleon brandy or just spirits, depending on the customer. The room was crowded when they went in. A long row of chairs ranged against one wall, and on the chairs sat the merchandise. There were stout Irish girls with flaming cheeks, some blue-eyed, milk-skinned English blondes, one sultry Jewess, a smattering of French-speaking farm girls, and, in the bargain corner, a few native women. Martell made his little joke, asking Jeannot if he would like a chair with the girls, then began talking with one from Quebec, asking her foolish questions about her family. Madame Georgine, who knew Jeannot, tugged at his jacket sleeve.
"Come over here," she said, and led him to a murky alcove. "Here, try this."
She poured liquor from a black bottle into a tiny glass and handed it to him.
"Go on, drink it. It's the real thing. Brandy? Napoleon brandy. We had a swell in here and he left it behind.
Ginot swallowed the fiery stuff and thought that if that was what Napoleon drank, his death was imminent. He smiled, pinched Madame Georgine's encarmined cheek, and turned back to the line.
Ginot, look!
It was Josime pointing with his pursed lips at a woman bent over her lap, avoiding the stares of the men.
See who that is?
No. Who is it?
It's that girl in the canoe when we come here. Long time ago. The Ottawa. The one give you that fern.
He studied the figure. Who could tell, the way she was slouched over? Fern? What fern? Who could remember after 6 or 8 years what a girl in a canoe had looked like? Josime. Josime could remember. Ginot walked over to her, said,
Hey, oh, pretty girl.
She looked up. She said,
Ginot?
Her eyes gleamed with tears. She was thin, half-starved, he reckoned. He didn't remember her, but she remembered him.
It'll get better by and by. Don't cry.
He went back to Josime, who was breathing hard.
Don't remember, he said. How'd that gal get here?
He asked Madame Georgine.
How you think? Some men brought her in and left her. Traders, fur traders. Bad trouble girl, her, and no good. Scratch and bite. I get rid her pretty soon.
When he looked again, Josime had led the girl to one of the tables and was talking earnestly, asking questions in the way he had of stretching his head forward as if to catch the faintest whisper. Suddenly, Ginot was sick of the place. He could feel the rot gut wrenching his innards. At the door, he looked back again. The girl was looking beyond Josime to Ginot with a pleading expression. Josime's head was close to hers, and he was still talking.
She don't hear a word he's saying, Ginot murmured.
Then he remembered he had all the money. Once more, he went to Madame Georgine and stuffed the money into her hands.
I'm paying for my brothers and our friend Martel. They're supposed to come to the Wing King later. They know it, but tell them anyway.
He walked along the plank sidewalks. He thought of Josime. He thought of the girl. He still did not recollect her. What he remembered about the time in the canoe was Josime's hard, bright stare. He had assumed it was aimed at all of the girls, a fixed gaze that went on and on. But it must have been for only that one. He felt a little sorry for Josime. In the morning, Amboise and Martel were waiting for him outside the Wing King.
Where's Josime?
He had a headache and saw they too were suffering. Amboise shook his head. There was a long silence.
Got to make tea, he said at last. Where's Josime? He took that girl off. Old madam screamed like wildcat, she can't go. He's got to pay her money. So he didn't have any money, but he give her something. Maybe he found some money he forgot in his pocket and she shut up. Josime said, tell you he's gone Manitoulin with that girl. Says we better wait. He comes back.
Wait where? No place here we can wait. We got no money.
Get work. Plenty sawmills here. You know, move the logs up into the mill. Sort logs in the mill pond. Other jobs. Plenty work if you know logs and water, hey?
He was right. They all found jobs at sawmills, and the cross-eyed, toothless owner of the Wing King, once a logger and riverman, said they could stay on as long as they could pay. They could, but Amboise and Martel began to drink their money up. Amboise said he didn't care. He liked to drink whiskey. Ginot, who also liked to drink whiskey and who didn't know how far it was to Manitoulin, hoped Josime would come back soon so they could get away from the city, back to the sober life of the camps. More than 2 months later, Ginot came into the Wing King storeroom and Josime was there, lying on his bed, his eyes closed. He sat up.
What took you so long time come back? Said Ginot. Brother, my life has changed greatly. I chop trees no more. I stay always with that girl on Manitoulin Island and give up white man ways, white man work. That girl, my wife. I come tell you, I go back to her now.
You are like Kunta, said Gino, slaved to a woman, and you talk different. Much time with that Manitoulin girl.
It is right for me to be with her in the forest, away from stinking men and the wounding of the land. It is what I want.
Gino thought he looked very much like Beatrix, especially his pale eyes.
I know, he said.
It is a joy that you do not know, said Josime stiffly.
They sat silent for a long time. Then Josime spoke again.
I wish you come with me. I know you will not, but I wish it. We are not so young now. You would feel a happiness to eat whitefish, see those people living good lives, not false white man lives like we do in lumber camp. One day, you come to Manitoulin and learn what I say is true.
I sure to come, Josime. Come visit, see you, your children. But you doing this makes me afraid. Maybe I wish I was the one do it.
Josime laughed.
You! You leave the axe! No, I do not think so. But I want to tell you something I have seen a day's paddle south from that country. Brother, I have seen with my own eyes the largest white pines that ever grew in the world. The Manitoulin people told me that pine tree forest is very big, maybe 1,000 English people's miles. It is their forest, and they move through it. Their rivers, and they travel on them, for they are traders, and have been traders for many generations. They are good people who have not forgotten the old ways. You must never tell any white man about this pine forest, for they will come in numbers like plaice, passenger pigeons, and cut it down. Never speak of it to anyone. Never.
He would not speak of it, but they would come anyway. A few weeks later, Gino, Amboise, and Martel drifted back to Maine. Before they went to Bangor to look for work, they returned to Penobscot Bay. Josime had a too small shirt that he wanted to give to his nephew Francis Outher's son, Edward Outher. He must be near grown by now.
Part 6. Fortune's a Right Whore. 1808 to 1826. 42. Inlaid Table. Captain James Duke, in his early 50s, was complicated, dark-haired, and somewhat handsome. He took a hard-headed and hard-handed stance to disguise an inner recognition of worthlessness. Quixotic, he swung from morbid self-pity to rigid authority over his crews and himself. The future flickered before him as a likely series of disappointments. On the annual occasion of an all-day drunk, his ill-starred birthday, he dragged out the piteous litany that he had been pitched onto a British ship as a midshipman in his 10th year, as an unwanted pup dog is tied to a sapling in the woods and left to be torn apart by wild beasts. Even his appointment had come about only because his grandfather, old Nicolaus Duke, wrote to the more ancient Dread Peacock and begged the favor of a recommendation. The favor granted, Nicolaus Duke and the antique peer died within weeks of each other and could be depended on no more. But James Duke lasted. Repeatedly passed over for promotion in favor of candidates from influential landed families or members of the peerage, he lasted. He had done moderately well on the examination, then stalled for years as a past midshipman. But the Napoleonic Wars had lofted him swiftly over a lieutenancy to post-captain, and there he stayed until in his 51st year a letter arrived from his Boston cousin Free Grace Duke asking if he would consider a director's seat on the board of Duke and Sons to fill the vacancy left by the death of his father, Sedley. That his father had died was a shock to James. He had heard no news from him nor of him for many years. He had never had a letter nor a remembrance, never a visit. He thought that if Sedley had left him anything in his will, it would be an insultingly paltry sum, as a single shilling, or a savage castigation for causing the death of his first wife, James's mother. He had always known why his father hated him. As the days passed, he considered the idea of sitting on the board of the family timber company. Little had ever come to James from the Duke's beyond a yearly allowance of £50. If he accepted, he would have to make concessions, would have to revert to being an American. He would bring a touch of English distinction to the no-doubt squalid board meetings of Duke and Sons, likely the reason they invited him to join them. He could imagine those meetings, a scarred oaken table with half a dozen backwoodsmen slouched around it on pine benches, tankards of rum-laced home-brewed beer, tipsy ribaldries, for he had no illusions that the Dukes were models of moral behavior. Before he could draft his cool note of refusal, a letter arrived from a Boston law office signed by the attorney Hugh Trumbull. It was late December, the days short and dark, the worst of the English year. Advocate Trumbull begged James's attendance at Trumbull and Tendril as soon as he might manage the journey in order to hear something to his advantage. Enclosed was a draft for £100, drawn on Duke and Sons, for his passage to Boston. So rarely had the words, "something to your advantage," come to him that he decided on the minute to accept Free Grace's offer and remove permanently to Boston. Advantage meant more than a single shilling. He made his arrangements and booked passage for Boston. The Western Blessing was crowded with German immigrants journeying to Pennsylvania to found a utopia, and these people quarreled incessantly with each other about the details of the earthly paradise to come. To keep free of them, James Duke stayed in his cabin during the day, coming out only to take the wintry air or to dine and drink with Captain Euclid Gunn, who was even older than himself, but of an equal rank. Over a roast chicken, they raked through sea acquaintances held in common. They spoke of retired and disabled friends as the level sank in the decanter. "Captain Richard Moore, one of the most ablest seamen I ever knew, is forced to open a herring stall in Bristol. You are a fortunate man, Captain Duke, to be connected to a wealthy family. Some of us depart from the sea to live out sad lives ashore selling fish or driving a goods cart. I myself have no expectations of a rich sinecure, but hope I will go to Davy Jones before I wheel a barrow of mussels." Shocked to hear that Dick Moore has come to such a pass. "But Captain Gunn, I am sure that a happier future awaits you than clam-mongering. Do you not have a reputation for fashioning small, attractive tables?"
"It is only my amusement, you know, never to make a living from it."
"You might try. Everyone admires small tables, as that one," he said, and he pointed to an example of the captain's handiwork, an ebon side table inlaid with a ship in full sail cut from walrus tusk ivory. "Any mariner's family would be happy to possess such a handsome article of furnishing."
"You must have it when you disembark. I will make another, but you shall take this one as a memento of your years at sea and this voyage. I insist. Look, it has a secret drawer where you may keep your love letters."
Once a week, other choice guests joined the captain's table, and once a female, Mistress Posy Brandon, a dark-haired lady of considerable stature, quite overtopping the gentlemen at the table, but sitting silent for the most part unless pressed to speak. She was traveling home after a long visit with a relative to rejoin her husband Winthrop Brandon, a Presbyterian preacher who had made his name with a book of virtuous precepts. Another passenger, Thomas Gort, showed her excessive attention. James understood why Gort fawned. She had great onyx-dark eyes fringed by thick lashes. But Gort made too much of her. When Mrs. Brandon said she had visited Madame Tussaud's exhibition at the Lyceum Theatre of Wax Curiosities of Crime, Gort begged for repulsive details. The lady demurred, saying she had averted her eyes before many of the exhibits.
"I do not see how a member of the gentler sex, even a German or French lady, could have fastened on such an unpleasant mode of expression," she said, and cut at her meat. "I understand she first gained her skill in making wax flowers for family funeral wreaths."
After that, she said nothing more. The days of tilting horizon passed slowly. As they neared the continent, they saw increasing dozens of ships, wooden leviathans, rope-strung like musical instruments, shimmering with raw salt. Boston Harbor was so jammed, they anchored a 20-minute row from the docks. James located his trunk, a scuffed brown affair, on the deck. He did not see the promised inlaid table with the boxes and bundles to go ashore, and found Captain Gunn on the bridge. "I thought I would thank you again for the table," he said. It seemed to him Captain Gunn showed a coolness. "Ah," he remarked. "Sir, I look forward to enjoying it in my new quarters." "Ah. Shall I fetch it on deck myself?"
"Ha! You, Woodrow!" he bellowed at a sailor. "Fetch the small table in my cabin to the deck for this gentleman."
There was undoubtedly a sneer embedded in the word gentleman. James Duke guessed that Captain Gunn was in his true self, a parsimonious man made momentarily generous by Madeira. He was crowded into the tender with 24 passengers, Bostonians from their accents. In their anxiety to get on shore, they were very restive, passing bundles back and forth. A portly matron stood up to receive a small trunk. The weight surprised her, and she swayed, tried to hold it, then fell with a shriek into the wintry harbor. Gasping, she clutched at the gunwale, and her weight dislodged 2 more passengers. Captain Duke stretched out his hand to a terrified man, and in slow but inexorable motion, the tender rose on its side and sent 10 or 12 more people bellowing and clawing over the side. Gasping, for he could not swim, James Duke thrashed his arms, trying for the gunwale. His hand touched it, though he could barely feel it. Then he went under again as the heavy woman wrapped one arm around him. He escaped his captor and with an atavistic swimming motion burst upward into the sweet air. Something clenched his hair and dragged him to the side of the tender. Something got hold of the back of his coat collar and hauled relentlessly. He came up over the gunwale, crashed into the bottom of the boat, and looked up at his savior. A woman wearing a black bonnet and staring at him with lustrous, intensely black eyes. Mistress Brandon, who had exhibited the strength of 2 men. Chattering thanks and promises to call on his rescuer in a few days, James Duke returned to his homeland on this first day of February. In a sopping freeze, he managed a cab to take him to the Pine Tree Inn. Waiting for his trunk to arrive, he stood as close as he could to the fire, drinking boiling tea. At last, the trunk was hauled up to his room, and trembling, he put on his warmest clothes. Wool, wool, good English wool. It was exceedingly cold in Boston. Snow fell an inch or two every day for a week until all was muffled and silent. Roofs, carriages, and still the snow came. 2 days after his arrival, and with a drumbeat headache, James Duke walked to the offices of Trumbull and Tendril, slipping on icy cobblestones. The clerk who let him in and took his hat gave him 2 swift, startled looks before his habitual air of indifference returned, an empty expression that classified the people he met as sidechairs or pen wipers. It was the same with the advocate Hugh Trumbull, whose mouth fell open and then closed. His wrinkled face suddenly creaked into a smile. He might have been English, thought James, taking in the fashionable double-breasted coat with notable lapels. Half laughing in welcome, Trumbull made James comfortable in a chair near the snapping fire. The clerk brought in tumblers of hot rum toddy.
"You quite shook me. It's uncanny how you resemble your late father."
Trumbull drank off half his glass of rum and waved his hand at the window, where the flying snow half obliterated the street and the buildings across the way.
"Would you believe that I have killed deer from this window?" he asked. "Of course, it was many years ago, and deer are now scarce. Now, sir," he said, "to business,"
and over the next hour laid out the details of Sedley Duke's will. Elated and confused, James Duke returned to the Pine Tree with a weight of keys in his pocket. In essence, Sedley Duke had regretted his long hatred. and left half of his rich estate to James, including his dwelling house north of Tremont Street, complete with 6 acres of garden land, a fruit orchard, 20 acres of fresh meadow, a 12-stall stable, 2 carriages and 6 matched pair of horses, nearly 2 million acres of forest in Maine, passed to Sedley from Charles Duke's old partner Forgeron, a collection of Indian relics, a stuffed crocodile, 8 silver platters, 4 and 20 pewter plates, a turtle-shell hafted knife, a library of 84 books, 2 hogsheads of Portuguese vino, 8 barrels of rum, 2 waistcoats embroidered with bucolic scenes, 5 turkey carpets, 6 warehouses of lumber, 27 acres of salt marsh, part interests in several ships, potash manufactories, a shingle factory, Ohio timberlands, bank accounts, and stocks. And more that he could not remember. Trumbull had enjoyed detailing the provisions of the will.
The servants are staying on at the house and hope that you will retain them. You may remember that your father called the property Black Swan and populated his pond with those birds. 60-odd years ago, it was all rough, gloomy forest, and now we see handsome estates. I would advise you to keep the servants, as they understand the peculiarities and virtues of the place, and will make the transition to Boston pleasanter for you.
James sat with his mouth open, hardly believing what he was hearing.
Mrs. Trumbull and I hope you will do us the favor of dinner with us a week hence. Some of your cousins will be in attendance, and we thought you might wish to meet them away from the offices.
Sir, said James. Sir.
His head aching fiercely and his throat a raw ribbon of fire, he took to his bed at the pine tree for the next 4 days and lay swooning and dreaming of the delights that lay before him. He would move to the house as soon as he was well, and then pay a call on the Winthrop Brandons and thank Mistress Brandon properly with a gift. But he was embarrassed to have been pulled from the water by a woman. He should have saved her. And should he wait until the Trumbulls' dinner party, or immediately pay a call on Cousin Freegrace Duke, who certainly knew of James's unexpected fortune? No doubt he would try to wheedle it away to himself and the other dukes, or at least to the failing business coffers, for the gang of backwoodsmen had likely put the company in disarray. Perhaps Sedley Duke had been the white sheep in a black flock. He directed the hired coachman to his father's, now his, house. They rolled up a curved drive to a house of rosy brick with a black lacquer door set off by pedimented windows. He counted 8 smoking chimneys. A gray-haired woman wearing a gray linsey-woolsey dress opened the door, and her eyes widened as she took him in. She curtsied and said, in a welcome English voice, that she was Mrs. Tubjoy.
Mr. Sedley's housekeeper, sir, and now in your service. We all welcome you.
As he stepped into the entrance hall, he was dashed into his childhood as though seated on a swing that someone had suddenly given a great shove. He knew every inch of this place. There was the complex mahogany staircase rising into the dim upper hall. There, a gleaming carpet rod, and there, there. The terrible hall stand, 10 feet high, intensely authoritarian. This piece of furniture, with its blotched-looking glass, its hat hooks and cloak holders, was the ceremonial guard of the house. Every day when Sedley came home, he had placed his umbrella in the crooked holder, hung his tall black hat on the hook, his greatcoat on another, and, divested of his city exterior, passed into the world of home. He went into his library and drank whiskey until the housemaid rang the bell for dinner. Young James and Sedley sat at opposite ends of the 16-foot table with never a word spoken. He shook the memory loose. In the hall behind Mrs. Tubjoy stood 6 servants. He caught vainly at their names. The beardless, grinning boy was Tom, the cook, Louisa. 2 men brought his trunk and Captain Gunn's small table into the hall. Mrs. Tubjoy said,
I am sure you wish to see the house, and after a little refreshment, rest until dinner? Follow me, sir, if you please. Perhaps you will wish to take your late father's room, Mr. James?
She asked, opening a heavy mahogany door. The room was large, the windows were large, and gave a view of great trunked oaks. Mrs. Tubjoy said,
Forgive my familiarity, Mr. James, but you strongly resemble my late employer.
Yes, Mr. Trumbull said so as well, but I cannot help it. I never saw the late Mr. Duke, my father, from the time I was a boy, so I did not know of the resemblance. The monstrous bed was mahogany with a fringed green canopy, the posts carved into dolphins and mermaids. He detected a faded scent of cigar smoke, wool, leather polish, and horsiness. As he leaned over the bed to examine the monogram on the pillow slip, another smell, altogether rancid and disgusting, rose from the mattress.
"Those coiled hair mattresses must be changed every few years," said Mrs. Tubjoy, seeing his flared nostrils.
"I am happy you mention this, Mrs. Tubjoy," he said. "Shall we not have all the old mattresses burned and replace them with best new?" On the third floor, they entered a room he liked immediately. It was moderate in size, but with a large fireplace. In front of the fireplace stood two companionable wing chairs upholstered in faded red brocade. He admired the sun-softened color and suddenly remembered the table with the ivory inlaid ship that Captain Gunn had grudged him. "Mrs. Tubjoy, could the boy bring my small table in the entryway up at once?"
"Of course, I'll see to it," she said,
and she glided from the room and down the stairs, gray and silent. Alone, he examined the room. The furnishings were of rosewood rather than mahogany, and the bed had plain posts. There was neither canopy nor carved dolphins. He liked the brilliant Turkey carpets on the floor and opened a small cabinet. It was empty, and he liked the emptiness. Above the washstand hung a large and slightly clouded mirror, and he saw himself in it, the dimmed image of a man who appeared resolute, strong, with no sign that he was unworthy. The windows looked out over the oaks toward a shining strip of sea, invisible from his father's room. He heard them on the stairs. Mrs. Tubjoy came in, followed by the grinning Tom lugging the table and seeming somewhat strained, although the table was small. Of course, ebony was heavy, ivory was heavy. "Put it there," said James to the boy, who stood breathing heavily and gripping the table with white fingers. He pointed to the space before the fireplace and between the wing chairs. The table was correct. This would be his room. 43. Error of Judgment. A visit to the stables was a heady experience. He had his choice of a barouche or a sporty gig, and Billy, the fat-cheeked stable boy, said there were four other vehicles in the carriage house, including a green sleigh and a very pretty coach. It was a sunny day. He chose the barouche, finished in gray enamel with silver fittings. Billy said, "Mr. Sedley bought the grays special for this carriage," and began to harness them. The coachman, Will Thing, came in, stuffing his arms into his livery jacket. He was garrulous and obsequious, sprinkling yes-sirs around as though casting handfuls of seed on new-raked soil. Out on the high road, he pointed out landmarks and distinguished points, the establishments and houses of leading merchants and men of account. He moved on to the likes and dislikes of Mr. Sedley, and so James came to know his father through the impressions of his coachman. The Winthrop Brandons lived in a small cottage in Williams Court near two taverns and a devotional bookshop. There was no room for the barouche to stand, and Will Thing said he would wait in the yard of the Liberty Cod across the way. As James walked up the tramped earth path to the door, in his hands his present of a silver dish wrapped in a length of muslin for Mistress Brandon, he heard unlikely sounds inside the house. Meaty thumps and a shrill cry.
"Kind Jesus, he is beating her!"
He stopped on the bottom step and stood irresolute. Should he leave and come another time, or knock on the door and perhaps engage with an enraged husband in the flower of fury? Was it not his responsibility to save the woman who had saved him? It was, and he knocked very briskly. There was a hoarse shriek. He knocked again. The house went silent. After long minutes, just as he was turning away, the door opened and Mistress Brandon stood on the sill, somewhat breathless and with heaving bosom.
"Mr. Duke! What a pleasure! Come in! Do come in, please!"
He looked at her but could see no signs of ill use beyond her rapid breathing and a disarranged black curl in front of one ear. The pupils of her beautiful eyes were dilated. He followed her into a disheveled sitting room where opened books covered an octagonal table. There was a sideboard choked with pewter, five doors, and a row of sunny windows.
"Mr. Duke, will you not take tea?"
"I would very much like to do so," he said, resting his gift on a pine chair with a broken rung.
"I will just be a moment. We keep no servant, so I prepare everything myself."
She strode out of the room, and he sat looking about him. The bookcase, behind its glass-fronted doors, carried the collected expository discourses of many scribbling preachers. He looked at several of the open pages of the books heaped on the octagonal table. All were sermons, and a half-filled sheet of foolscap, pen and ink, indicated that the master of the house, Reverend Brandon, was cribbing up filler for his coming sermon. James heard faint sounds in the distance, the rattling of a stove lid, a clinking sound, and nearby, a very discreet, low moan. He went to the window and looked out, was about to sit down again when there was a slithering sound behind one of the doors. He turned. The door was ajar, and through the gap he saw the raw, wet face of a man of about 40, fair hair matted and sweaty, who muttered something between bleeding lips, then, at the jangle of the approaching tea tray, darted away.
"Here we are,"
cried Mistress Brandon merrily, coming into the room with the tray. She looked about, but there was no place to put it.
"Just hold this a moment, will you?" she said, thrusting the tray at him.
He held it, his mind whirring with curiosity. She swept the octagonal table free of the books of sermons with a strong arm, sent them crashing to the floor. She took the tray from his astonished hands.
"There, don't mind all the old books, just Mr. Brandon's work. He has a perfectly good study, but prefers to spraddle his books on the tea table. He says the light is better, but I think he does it to annoy. He was struck by lightning 2 summers ago, and has been somewhat difficult since that day."
The great dark eyes gazed on him so intently, he began to stammer and blurt.
"I have known men, mariners, others, struck by lightning bolts myself, others, you understand, and when it does not kill them, hurt them, outright, it disorders their minds, often to a marked degree. Some recover. Some never. Some."
And he went on, describing several cases of lightning-induced mental derangement.
"I fear that is the case with Mr. Brandon. I live in expectation that he will do himself a mortal injury. So disordered are his mental faculties. He has great trouble preaching. He wanders about the streets at night."
She held out a plate of walnut cakes, and he took one. She said, in an aggrieved tone,
"These walnuts I gathered with my father last season. I picked out hundreds of nut meats and stored them for winter use. If Mr. Brandon made a better living, we might have money to employ a gardener and kitchen help who would gather the nuts. It is very trying to scrimp along. I was not brought up to live in this manner. I was quite spoiled on my visit to my mother's aunt in England. Her husband is a cloth merchant, and everything in their country house is of the best quality. They have a city house as well in London, and I wish you could see it. A veritable treasure."
Again, the dark gaze.
"Mr. Parson, Minister Brandon, was unable to accompany you?"
"Quite unable. He has a little flock of parishioners and feels the responsibility. Also, his behavior is somewhat unpredictable, and I thought it better not to bring him into polite society. A neighbor woman looked after him while I was away."
He took the bull by the horns. While you were preparing tea, I thought I saw, Mr. Brandon, I assumed. He peeped in that door, James said, and he pointed in an agony of embarrassment. He looked somewhat out of order. In fact, he thought Mr. Brandon had looked swinishly drunk.
I have no doubt, she said. He is always out of order. It is best to take no notice of his hijinks when he is in his fits. There seemed nothing to say to this. She cast her eyes down. A long silence fell. He sensed she was listening for noises in the back of the house. He studied her face, trying to combat the power of the black eyes by finding faults with her nose, too long, and her mouth, thin and wide. Unable to think of more conversation, after the disclosures of the damaged husband, it was too late to introduce the topic of weather. James Duke, suddenly glib, began to rattle off details of his good fortune, his surprise and delight at receiving a large inheritance from his long-estranged father. You see, he said, I was sent away from home at a young age to become a maritime officer, and over the years we never corresponded. My mother died at my birth, and my father always blamed me for it. Still, I have survived, and now come into a good situation. Mistress Brandon, turning her attention wholly on him, said,
But what a fortunate outcome! We all dream that a rich relative will shower us with gold and manses, but you are the first one I have ever known who has experienced such a turnover. What will you now do? Live happily ever after? Is your wife ecstatic?
I will participate in the affairs of the family company, Duke and Sons, in what capacity I am not yet secure. And as to the other, I have no wife. I have ever been single.
Indeed, cried Mistress Brandon. Did you say Duke and Sons? The great timber company?
Her eyes were forest pools. Yes, it is the family business, and I am joining it. I have been asked to serve on the board, as my father did. But the truth is that I am somewhat nervous, as I know very little about the timber trade.
My dear Mr. Duke, perhaps I may be of help to you. I am the daughter of Phineas Breeley of the Breeley Lumber Contractors in New Brunswick. He has had many dealings in Maine. As a girl, I assisted my father in his paperwork. I know something of the business, and all that I know I shall impart to you. And then we must find you a wife.
James visited the Brandons again the next week. Mrs. Brandon let him in. Mr. Brandon was nowhere in sight.
Closeted with another fit, said Mistress Brandon, whose first name, he learned, was Posy.
She smiled. She looked at his lips when he spoke, questioned him about his cousins and the Duke business, asked his advice on the choice between a deep blue shawl and one of rose cashmere. And then, from the corner cupboard, she pulled out a sheaf of closely inscribed pages held together by a dressmaker's pin, detailing the structure and proceedings of her father's timber contracting business, his work as timber looker, the cheapest kinds of lumber camps, where to find the best men, Penobscot men, found in Bangor. He thought he had never met so intelligent and fine a woman, and told her so. To himself, he thought that not only were her eyes beautiful, but she had the grace of a swan, the voice of a dove. Batting those beautiful eyes and blushing from cleavage to hairline, she begged him to call on her again the next week when he should have digested all the workings of her timber business scrawls. She would answer his questions and even quiz him if he thought it beneficial. But before then came the dinner at the Trumbulls, 7 the next evening. He would at last meet the Duke cousins. It was a bitter cold and blowy evening spitting snow. Would spring never come? He arrived at the Trumbull house 1 minute before 7, and in the near dark saw the loom of a brick building. A black man in black livery opened the door for him. At the same moment, the cousins and their wives arrived in their coach. They exchanged names and greetings in the vestibule while Mr. Trumbull urged them into the parlor, where a snapping fire spread out billows of heat. A bald-domed giant in an exquisite French-embroidered waistcoat stood near the fire holding a glass. This was the law partner, Josiah Tendril, and he crushed James's hand, saying in a blast of brandy,
very like indeed.
Cousin Free Grace Duke was plump and short, breathing with asthmatic stertor. Free Grace's brother Edward was a large, heavy man like his father, George Pickering Duke. Neither resembled the backwoodsman of James's imagination. Free Grace's wife Lenore was a pale beauty with smoky eyes and a flaxen chignon who would attract attention in any gathering. James was astonished. How had such a fat little man got such a beautiful wife? Edward's wife Lydia was of a more common type, brown braids wound around her head and a habit of clearing her throat before she spoke. They all kept glancing at James, and Free Grace finally said,
"Forgive the scrutiny, but you are uncommon similar in appearance to Sedley. It is as if he went away for 6 months to the Fountain of Youth, and tonight has rejoined us."
James did not like the constant references to his father as the shaper of his appearance, however true they might be. A maid brought hot toddies for the gentlemen and glasses of sherry for the ladies. They spoke of the unseasonable weather and the cold.
"Truly unusual the way this winter hangs on," said Mrs. Trumbull. "Ah, James," said Lenore, "you will harden up in Boston. The dulcet climate of England is in your distant past. Here we must wrap in furs to keep alive. Going out in the winter or a spring like this one is always a dangerous adventure."
Josiah Tendril told of a great snowstorm that had come in his childhood.
"The snow fell for 5 days, and when it ceased, the drifts were up to the eaves of 3-story houses. It took 15 men 3 days to shovel us out."
The dinner was long, but not a single word was spoken about the business, Duke and Sons. At last, an English pudding streaked with blue brandy fire came in, and when it was reduced to a rubble of crumbs, the ladies retired to Mrs. Trumbull's sitting room, and the men to the library for cigars and imported cognac.
"I beg you, tell me more of the family," said James. "I remember a large number of cousins. Are not some of them involved in the family business?"
Edward sighed.
"Time has not been kind to the family. We lost almost an entire generation. Your Uncle Pete, on a visit to Virginia, took the cholera in the very warm summer of, what, years ago now, and did not survive the attack. He is buried there. Aunt Patience Deckbolt suffered mental exhaustion and finally passed away in her sleep. 3 of her daughters still live in the city with their husbands and families, and you shall meet them at a future gathering. None of their husbands, well, I shall forbear to describe the husbands. Patience's grandson Cyrus is a clever young man and shows some promise for the company. We employed him. In time he will ascend the ladder of success. You will meet him when we have our meeting in June. Your half-siblings, Sedley's second family, have all repaired to Philadelphia. Maury, the oldest, who is Sedley's only other son, your half-brother, I suppose we might say, works for a banking firm, and I wish he had remained in Boston, as he is certainly good timber."
"And are there no other cousins and relatives I should know?"
"Your great-uncle, old Outher Duquet, returned to Amsterdam or Leiden and lived there. He continued to draw his stipend from the business to the end. But now he is gone. His half-breed daughter lived in flagrant concubinage with an Indian in Outher's house on Penobscot Bay. They produced an army of Indian brats. They are quite unknown to us. I have mentioned Cyrus Hempstead, and we have Leonard Vogel, the only son of your great-aunt Dorcha Duque. So you see, it comes down to you to help replenish our ideas and fortune."
Weeks passed, and James often called on Mrs. Brandon. They had become great friends. It was foolish to pretend he was calling on both husband and wife. Mr. Brandon was always in his fits, and James had never actually seen him save for the glimpse of wild eyes on his first visit. He had read attentively through Mrs. Brandon's notes on her father's timber business.
"There is still so much I do not understand," he said.
"For example, I hear everywhere that Maine is the place for the best pine, but I know little or nothing of Maine."
"What could be easier? Maine is not yet a state, but sure to be very soon. It is a large territory, heavy with forests, especially the valuable white pine. Maine is spotted with 1,000 lakes and ponds, like a slice of yeasty bread is riddled with holes, has great rivers, each with 100 branches. I can name some of them for you, and next time you come, I will have a map of sorts showing the best waterways, the Androscoggin, Kennebec, St. George, St. John, and the Allegash, and the best, the Penobscot. All the rivers of Maine have countless streams feeding them, but you can only get logs down them with dams in the time of the spring freshets."
He could hardly think when she looked at him so intensely and struggled to find sensible questions. One afternoon he came into the now familiar parlor and found her sitting at the table with a stack of bills and accounts. Her face showed traces of tears, and wiping them away and throwing down her pen, she rushed into the kitchen to make the tea. He glanced over the accounts. Ye gods, what was she living on? The Brandons had no money at all. And was it right that such an intelligent and handsome woman had to scratch up the tea herself in some back kitchen? Although he had never been in any of the other rooms of the house, he set out for the kitchen. He would help her. Damn, he would help her. She was stuffing kindling into the stove. The kitchen smelled of bad drains and the disagreeable odor of the wet soapstone sink, old ashes and a sour dishclout. She turned, frowning horribly when she heard his footstep. But the frown transformed into a tear-wet, dimpled smile when she saw it was James.
"Ah, I thought..."
He knew what she thought. She thought it was the fit-prone Mr. Brandon blundering in on her, perhaps twitching and spewing, pissing in his filthy pants. "My dear," he said, and took her hand. "You shall not endure this another day. I shall hire a woman to come in and do for you at once. Let us now forget the tea. Go into the parlor and have a little talk about what must be done." For he intended to pay up those nagging past due accounts, intended to have Mr. Brandon put in an asylum, intended much more. He had money and he would put it to use. He could get what he wanted, and he wanted Posy Brandon. She confessed that she had pawned the silver dish he had brought her to pay some of the bills and to buy food. He was deeply shocked and deeply pleased that he could set matters right. When he left the house 2 hours later, he had set changes in motion.
"Come in, sir," said Mrs. Deer, the new cook, who also served as housemaid, opening the door.
The parlor table gleamed with waxy luster, and there was a jar of pussy willows on the windowsill. He could smell something pleasant in the distant kitchen. Something Mrs. Deer said was,
"A rhubarb roly-poly, first rhubarb of the year."
And as was now his right, he went to that delicious room where Mrs. Deer had performed miracles. The new stove glowed. The soapstone sink no longer reeked.
"Very good, Mrs. Deer. Have you had any trouble with Mr. Brandon?"
"No, sir. I make him bread and butter and hot milk, which Dr. Hudson says is good for deranged people. Mrs. Brandon takes it to him and brings back the dishes."
She came closer and whispered,
"But to have to lock away the leftover joint as he strives for meat."
"I hope we will have a solution to the problem before long. I met with Dr. Hudson myself this morning. Would you be so good as to bring tea into the parlour while I discuss the doctor's findings with Mistress Brandon?"
"And dried apple pie," she said, pointing with her chin, "or roly-poly?"
"And pie," he agreed, for rhubarb could be sour.
"My dear," he said to Posy Brandon, waving his hand over his saucer of steaming pie, "I spoke with Dr. Hudson this morning for some time. He is of two opinions. He thinks it possible that Mr. Brandon may some day come to his senses. He thinks fresh air would be very good for him, and a place to walk and exercise. To that end, he suggests that you send Mr. Brandon to the care of a farm family. They would be glad of the extra money, and would keep him clean and expose him to much fresh air. He has a farmer in mind, a Jeremiah Taunton, who lives about 5 miles out of town, a man of calm ways. His wife is a generous woman, very pleasant and quiet. They have 2 or 3 children. They would welcome Mr. Brandon and house him comfortably. Does that not sound a good solution?
Oh, yes, yes. But you said Dr. Hudson had 2 opinions.
I did, and he does. He said, should by any chance Mr. Brandon not thrive in the farmer's care, or should he become wild and frenetic, it might be possible to arrange for him to be housed in Williamsburg, in Virginia, at the Public Hospital for Persons of Insane and Disordered Minds, a unique institution that Boston absolutely must emulate. Here we see the mad and incompetent wandering the countryside, but in Williamsburg they are kept in a special place and treated. The caretakers effect many cures with plunge baths, various drugs, bleeding, and certain salves. There are exercise yards.
It sounds very well. But first, let us send him to the farmer. Should we not send his books of sermons as well? He might resume reading and writing. It meant much to him in earlier times before that lightning strike.
I will ask, Dr. Hudson. He did mention complete rest and quiet, but perhaps books would be allowed. This pie is delicious, is it not? Are you pleased with Mrs. Deer?
I am most pleased, and with Mrs. Blitter, who is a fair enough housekeeper. You are very good to me, and I am grateful.
She looked at him with her great dark eyes. But the next day he called again to say that books would not be allowed. Books could cause brain fever even in people who had not been struck by lightning. The doctor himself would take Mr. Brandon to the farm on the coming Monday. In his breast pocket, James heard the doctor's bill crackle a little. A small price to get rid of the wretched Brandon. XLIV. Keepsake. Spring came at last in early June, a rushing spate of warm days, the gutters streaming with meltwater, people smiling and walking about as though their legs were new made. Birds raced through the branches. The smell of earth dizzied the senses. Posy Brandon opened the windows of her renovated and refurnished house before James Duke arrived for his afternoon tea. But he was late. She went to the window 100 times and peered down the street, hoping to see the gig bowling along. On the tea table lay a tiny packet wrapped in blue paper, the minuscule label bearing the words, James Duke, a keepsake. Would he not find it presumptuous? He would surely take his leave immediately, leaving it exposed on the table. He would withdraw Mrs. Deer and Mrs. Blitter. The bills would pile up. Why did he not come? Was her benefactor ill, or had he met with an accident? Surely he would have sent a messenger for any ordinary delay. Had he somehow found out about it, the keepsake? She paced. The sunlight color began to deepen, and late afternoon chill flowed into the room. She closed the window and called for Mrs. Blitter.
I am worried that Mr. Duke is delayed for some reason, and it grows chill. I think we need a small fire in this room. If he does not come soon, I must send a messenger to inquire.
We can send Mrs. Deer's boy. That slow coach is still in the kitchen. He has been at it all day, taking out the old flour and molasses barrels.
Her voice was scornful.
Yes, let us send him. Here, I will write a brief note.
But before the fire was burning well, Mrs. Deer's boy was back.
He was at the corner. I give him your note, but he's right at the gate. Here is horse.
I'm extremely sorry to be late, said James Duke. I was delayed by Dr. Hudson, who called on me only moments before I left. To be brief about it, he says that Mr. Brandon has become ill from some other source than his derangement. He coughs continuously and cannot keep any food down. He's very thin and weak.
To spare the farmer's wife extra work, I have hired a day nurse to assist, for he is in bed in his room and cannot rise from it. Dr. Hudson has ordered 2 fresh eggs a day beaten into warm milk with a spoonful of rum, and says he may recover with the warm days. But he may not. We can only wait. Her entire body flooded with relief. That Mr. Brandon would make a generous exit was her deepest wish. It changed the afternoon. They both sat silent and pensive, both thinking of Mr. Brandon. She could not now give James Duke the gift. It would not be apropos. At first opportunity, she slid the little packet up her sleeve unobserved. So they sat drinking tea and saying very little until the twilight deepened. "I must go, I fear," said James Duke, rising. "I wish..." But what he wished was not spoken.
"Of course I would like to see Mr. Brandon if there comes any crisis," she murmured.
"Dr. Hudson said he would come straight to you if the illness took a grave turn."
As he spoke, the doctor's gig turned into the street and drew up before the house.
"Oh, heavens!" said Mrs. Brandon.
James stood waiting, exultation seizing him.
"Dr. Hudson, ma'am," said Mrs. Blitter, opening the parlor door to show him in.
"Bring more tea, Blitter," said Mrs. Brandon.
She looked at the doctor. His face was expressionless, noncommittal.
"Dr. Hudson, do take tea with us," she said, although her bladder was bursting with tea. "I will just see to it,"
and she strode briskly out of the room. James Duke looked at him.
"Is there a change?"
he asked in a low voice.
"There is a change," the doctor answered, and said nothing more, waiting for Mrs. Brandon to return. The lady returned, skirts swishing with the violence of her stride.
"Please tell us, doctor, how Mr. Brandon does."
Her voice was calm and steady.
"I am happy to say that he has rallied enough to eat heartily and drink like a camel. His derangement seems rather more settled as well. I think he must have passed some sort of crisis. He recognized me, inquired after your health, praised the farmer and his wife. He still objects to milk and bread, but in a week or so we may try him with breast of chicken. I feel he might be able to come home soon. Certainly the day nurse is no longer needed," he said, with a nod at James indicating his release from that expense. Posey was stunned into silence for a long, long beat.
"Ah, but can I care for him here? The space is so limited, and the air is not the bracing country air, and certainly not if his derangement persists."
The fresh tea tray and a dish of seed cake arrived. Posey Brandon poured with a steady hand.
"Sugar? Yes, lemon?"
She passed a cup to the doctor.
"We will wait and see if he continues to improve. I allowed that tonight he may sleep on the farmhouse porch for the benefits of fresh air. In a week, if he has grown stronger, I think he will be little trouble. I can always send the nurse with him if there is any doubt. It's rather an interesting case, and it would be far easier for me to follow his progress if he were here instead of out in the country. Wouldn't you agree, Mr. Duke?"
"Of course," said James Duke in a grudging voice. "Who could disagree?"
When the clock struck the half hour, the men rose, made their goodbyes, and went out together. James sent Mrs. Brandon a scorching look she quite understood. She smiled and nodded, and as soon as the door closed, ran to her room muttering sailor's curses and threw herself into the pillows. In the street gloaming, it was difficult to see the doctor's expression when James asked him if he might call on Mr. Brandon.
"Perhaps in a day or two you might, but I fear that the appearance of a stranger alone might startle him into a relapse. I equally do not yet approve a visit from Mrs. Brandon. It is one of his crotchets that he has developed a fear of her, and claims, ridiculous as it sounds, that she somehow harms him. But that will likely pass as he recovers his reason. Shall we go out to the farm together in the morning?"
"If I find I have no other appointments, that would be agreeable," said James Duke.
But later, when the moon rose, he went to the stable, saddled his horse, and in the gathering darkness took the high road out of the city toward the farm, where Mr. Brandon lay dreaming of rib roast.